Spectrum Business works with small businesses nationwide, so we know that running your own business means doing it all. Marketing, sales, inventory, customer service, and more. Spectrum One for Business helps you keep it all connected for just $49.99 a month. Get fast, reliable internet, advanced Wi-Fi with Security Shield, and a free mobile line for one low price. Stay connected and do it all with Spectrum One for Business. Only $49.99 a month. Go to spectrum.com/business to learn more. Restrictions apply. Services not available in all areas.
This episode is brought to you by Essentia. A better you starts with better hydration. Essentia is on a mission to inspire people to do what matters most. Their proprietary ionization process transforms water from any source into ionized alkaline water, providing water that's 99.9% pure with a pH of 9.5 or higher. Essentia overachieving H2O, the number one ionized alkaline water. Shop now.
This is First Draft, a dialogue on writing. I'm Mitzi Rapkin. This is a show about craft, the writing life, and the themes that are present in a writer's work. Every interview is a journey. I don't really know where our conversation is going to go, but I do know that it's fascinating every time, and one way or another we seem to get around to what it means to be human and how through craft that idea is articulated on the page. Thank you for joining me on this literary pilgrimage into the mind of one writer at a time. My interview today is with Steve Almond, author of the nonfiction book, Truth is the Arrow, Mercy is the Bow, a DIY manual for the construction of stories.
By my way of thinking, what I was trying to do was write a book that would empower as many people as possible to recognize their creativity as something they not have a right to so much as they have a great opportunity to do something with the painful, confusing feelings they have, all the questions that are floating around inside them.
We'll be back with Steve Almond after these essential words. Here's what I want to say about pitching for patrons. It's my least favorite thing to do, but it supports my most favorite thing to do. Share this podcast with the world and with you. And so I'm wondering, do you get something out of this? Do you listen more than 8 times a year? Is there something of value for you in these episodes? If the answer to any of these questions is yes, then why not support this content by becoming a patron of First Draft? You can do that at patreon.com/firstdraftwriters. Here's the common conversation I have at parties. Okay, I don't really go to parties because I'm always doing this, but this is a common conversation I have about this podcast. So why did you start this? Someone asks. I don't really know. I was a radio reporter for years and getting my MFA in fiction, and I missed interviewing people. So I combined these two things and started this show. I didn't really think about what I was doing. I didn't have a master plan. It just seemed like a fun idea at the time. And I still don't really have a master plan, but it's been 10 years that I've been doing this. So then they asked, do you make money? And the answer is, I have some incredible patrons, but they come and go. And lately, for whatever reason, and this is really vulnerable here, more people have left than joined. I can't pretend to know why, but in exit surveys, they usually say it's for financial reasons and that they really love the content. And I get that. I really get it because there are expenses to make this podcast and financial needs to make this podcast. I will say that every hour I'm working on this is time I'm not spending at a quote unquote paying gig. Times have changed since we got our newspapers on our stoops twice a day. You know that. Our content comes from all over the place. But in this case, there isn't an AI behind this, just an I, which is me, Mitzi, all by my lonesome, doing the research, booking the guests, reading their work, conducting the interview, uploading it into the podcast world, and then doing it again and again and again, more than 50 times in the last year. I produce one episode a week, and that is on top of all my other jobs, which is why I don't go to parties or really do anything on the weekends except for this. So if you value this podcast, please consider supporting it with a financial contribution. Membership starts at $6 a month and includes extras like writing tips, cuts that didn't make it into the final show, End of the year thank you gifts, ad-free, pitch-free episodes so you won't have to hear this again, and more. I think in this world, we have to support what we love, and there is an energy there that comes back to us. So please go to patreon.com/firstdraftwriters and become a supporter of First Draft today. It still doesn't make a shred of sense that I'm doing this podcast. Still, here I am after a decade. But Rumi said, set your life on fire. Seek those who fan your flames. So I'm inviting you to warm yourself by this fire and bring your fan along. Patreon.com/firstdraftwriters. And on to the show. My guest today is Steve Almond, author of 12 books of fiction and nonfiction, including the New York Times bestsellers Candy Freak and Against Football. His recent books include the novel All the Secrets of the World and William Stoner and the Battle for the Inner Life. For 4 years, Steve hosted the New York Times Dear Sugar podcast with Cheryl Strayed. He is the recipient of a 2022 NEA grant in fiction, and his short stories have been anthologized in the Best American Short Stories, the Pushcart Prize, Best American Erotica, and Best American Mystery Series. His new book is Truth is the Arrow, Mercy is the Bow, a DIY manual for the construction of stories. We began the interview with Steve Almond talking about the transition from journalism to fiction and how he had a hard time understanding creative writing at first.
I'm not somebody who's like steeped in craft books. I didn't sit there and say, oh, I must write a craft book or let me study in the world of craft books. But what I felt like is I have screwed up so many times in such clearly discernible ways. I have failed over and over in various genres. But I've kept going. And along the way, those failures have taught me a lot about the mistakes that I'm making, the category of mistakes that I'm making. Like if I don't have a narrator to convey the proper information, and I just out of my insecurity leap into a scene, that's not going to work. The reader's going to feel like they're thrown in a trunk and they're going to get knocked around for a little while, no matter how beautiful my language is or no matter how beautiful I think it is. And then they're going to get tired of it and they're going to get out of the trunk and say, I'm going to go ride in a car where they know where they're going. And they don't throw me in the trunk. They tell me we're headed to the darkest part on the map. So for me, like what's been empowering is to make a bunch of mistakes as a writer and figure out the nature of those mistakes and gain, I wouldn't even say mastery, but like occasional competence with like a dash of mastery. And then to be able to put language to that and understand it and then say it to my students, usually over and over and over again. And I felt like that's the kind of book that I want to write. It's not really about craft so much as it's about the creative struggle and the fact that you're going to fail. And rather than getting down on yourself about that, you should say, well, what can I learn from that? And so I tried to write the book, not from the perspective of a know-it-all, but like you're saying, the perspective of somebody who's a writer who's mostly messed up and has tried to learn from those mess ups.
Do you think that there's something with writing craft, with a craft book and writing advice that is, could end up with something that's formulaic for people when they write their novels? I mean, I don't think so. But I'm curious, like, I feel like there's like your advice and then there's some other mystery involved, but yeah. Mm-hmm. Does that make sense?
Well, it does in the sense that I didn't want to write that kind of craft book. I didn't want to write that kind of book. That's why I gave it this weird title, Truth is the Arrow, Mercy is the Bow, which is, who knows what that means. I mean, I know what it means. It means you're only going to get as truthful as your mercy. You only get as deep into the truth as your mercy will allow. You have to go aiming for forgiveness. Otherwise, you get too anxious and upset and you'll get inhibited. But the subtitle was also important, a DIY kit for the construction of stories. Not here's how you do it. Here's how you make your outline. Here's how you get your first 1,000 words. Here's where you need to have conflict introduced. Here's the story arc. Like there are craft books like that that are more organized, that have a clearer sort of theory of the case. That's not the kind of book I could write because it's not how I operate in, because I think most of the things that hold writers back, and this really applies to anybody who's creative, it's insecurity and doubt and like the evil voices inside you, your ego need and your competitiveness and your envy and the things that distract you from the story that you came to tell, or the painting you came to make, or the film or the song. It's about disinhibiting people and getting them to have a chain of associations that later on down the path, they'll cleave to a chain of consequence. And then you have plot, right? But unless people can be relaxed and disinhibited and can allow that part of their brain that's the creative, imaginative part, what we call the muse sometimes, unless that's operating and everybody in the room is nice and relaxed, it's not going to be any good. It's going to feel overdetermined. So for me, I'm basically offering sort of a set of essays, I guess they're essays, right? On a whole range of topics. Some of them are very particularly about craft in the first third of the book, but I'm also interested in where creativity comes from. Like, where do stories come from? My only theory of the case is that stories are how human beings understand their own lives, and that part of what we're trying to do, whether we write it down or try to get it published as we move through life, is trying to understand what we've lived through and have some perspective, a merciful perspective on it. And I wanted to write, therefore, about like, what are the things that are that create that desire to tell a story? And for me, there are things, I call them hauntings, that are obsession, desire that's placed in doubt, states of disequilibrium, our efforts to use our sort of comic impulse to forgive ourselves for the worst moments. And I wanted to have a section that was just about, okay, let's get you in the mood. Let's get you writing in a very low pressure way. And then I really wanted, the heart of the book to me is about the evil voices, so that the reader of this book who's trying to create in some way knows they're not alone. Yes, I was trying to, in a way, sort of give people some tools that are very technical and some advice that's psychological and emotional and some, you know, kind of sources of inspiration that will allow them to kind of walk away from the book and try writing in a short burst and sort of see what it feels like to get into that disinhibited associative state themselves.
So I think part of what you're saying right now and in this book is that you bring everything you are to a writing project. Like, you cannot divorce yourself from your life experience, from the way that you see things, from your perspective. And that's what's so beautiful about books. It's like, you are, even if it's about monsters and cartoon characters, it's really also about you or something you've experienced. And so I'm wondering if you could talk more about truth and mercy.
Yeah, I mean, I think the point that you're making, when people say, oh, I don't write autobiographical work, in this way that's sort of saying like, oh, I'm not just one of those cheesy memoirists who needs to lean on my lived experience. I'm like, well, where's your stuff come from? If it's any good, it comes from the deepest part of you. It comes from your preoccupations, your obsessions, your history, the things that in one way or another have haunted you. And even if you sublimate it into this amazing fiction, it's still you. The engine has to be your passion, your unresolved questions and doubts and passions. And so I think that's really that's how I feel about it, is that you're always writing in a deeply personal way. Maybe you're really good at finding a fictional disguise for those obsessions or concerns, but if the work's any good, it's going to reach down to the deepest part of you. And that's what you have to offer the world.
Yeah. And I think that's why it's so important, and you talk about this, to not judge your characters.
Now, that's different than saying, I refuse to describe the worst thing they did. I refuse to describe the moment when they were petty, the moment when they were cruel, the moment when they were self-involved. There's a terrible moment in the book where I'm writing about a period where, I think it's in the piece that's about writer's block, a love story, or maybe it's the one about doubt and disequilibrium. It's one of those sunny beach read pieces. But, you know, there's a lot of darkness. Anybody who, like being a stand-up comic, anybody who is writing or creating, I think they're trying to contend with a lot of dark stuff. And part of the reason some of the stories in the book are concerned with that is I feel like that's kind of your job is to get that stuff out in the opening and get everybody to stop feeling ashamed of when we feel uncertainty or doubt or when we're blocked in some way. At any rate, the story is my mom comes to town before she died, and she's just sort of done the final exam, or she's doing the final exam for her psychoanalytic training. And I was pretty depressed and down, and I just had a dinner with her one night, and I'm sort of trying to tell her, I kind of think my life's falling apart. I don't know what I'm doing. I can't keep it together. And her response was not like, oh, Uchki Puchki, I'll take care of you. It was like, hey, I get it, but I have a really busy week, and I gotta have a boundary here. I can't take care of you in this moment. Now, there's one reading of that, Mitzi, that's like, wow, my mom really didn't come through in this moment. And that's one reading of it that I sort of carried around for a while. And then another reading is, this woman spent her entire life taking care of needy, insecure men. Her father, her husband, her three sons, and she was good and sick of it. And she needed to take care of her own creative and intellectual life. And at that particular moment, not because she was evil or solipsistic or anything, just because she's human, she couldn't say, okay, I will tend to your wounds now. She had to say, in some sense, okay, I understand. I hear you. I'm sorry you're going through that, but I gotta take care of me right now. This is a big week for me. So if you see what I mean, different people can have a different view of that interaction, and it's still possible to understand that both parties were doing kind of what they were destined to do, what they had to do.
I think, too, what's so amazing about fiction is if, say, you were stuck on a scene like that, you can change one thing that changes the whole meaning of that. Because if you put that scene as you did, maybe you were in your 30s, but if you changed it and you were 5, it would be a totally different thing.
That's right. Or if I changed it and, my mother was on her deathbed, and I was coming to her to, sort of ask her to keep me together one last time, she might say that you got it all wrong. You need to be taking care of me in this moment, right? I do think, and it's important to note, like, I really do feel like when you just have to have an honest contract with the reader. And part of what's exciting about fiction is, that's right, you can change things for dramatic effect. You know, in life, we're constantly avoiding conflict. In life, we're constantly inhibiting ourselves. When we have a desire and we think it might get us into trouble or destabilize us, we hold ourselves back. In fiction, we don't have to hang out with those people. We can go to the party with the enabler. We can get a little bit out of control. We can confront a character who in real life we might be avoiding and dodging. So I think that's really exciting. And that's, part of what makes fiction in some ways, more dramatically satisfying potentially, but it also makes it more terrifying because suddenly you could do anything. You can get the characters into all kinds of danger. What I feel like you have to do though with the reader is be honest. That scene with my mom, I recalled it as best I could. I don't remember whether I started crying at the dinner or whether I cried later. And I think you need to then be honest about that. You can't say, there I was weeping over my huevos rancheros. You have to actually say, if you don't remember, I don't remember. I know that I cried. I can't remember exactly when it happened. I think that's what I take to be, and it's important because I really do think that your job is to tell the truth about the things that matter to you most deeply. But ultimately, when that's nonfiction, that's a radically subjective version of events that objectively took place. If my mom was telling that version of the story, she would remember it differently, right? We create our memories. And when you claim the mantle of being the storyteller, that feels really intoxicating. There's a lot of power to it, but that's also a big responsibility. You're suddenly presenting to the world your version of something. And I think you need to be humble enough to basically say, I remember it this way. But my brother, I remember hitting my brother when he was 12 years old and I was 10, and I was, he was such a hero to me, but he was so mean to me. I remember hitting him with that baseball bat, in the dirt fields of Hollister, California, some lost weekend back in the 70s. And I remember that, I remember the blood spurting out of his mouth, and I remember my panic at what I'd done. He remembers it quite differently. In my view, I was kind of going after him, and I knew he was behind me. And when I swung that bat back, hey, that was my subconscious anger and aggression taking over. He says, Steve, that wasn't the story at all. I was warned repeatedly. I stepped into the path of that bat. And the question then becomes, well, who's right? What can we definitively say? The only thing you can say is there was blood and there's a scar that's on his lip. That's all we can definitively establish. The rest is a radically subjective version of things, of events that objectively took place. And it's great if you don't want to stick to events that objectively took place and you want to consciously invent them. Terrific. Just be honest with the reader about what that's called. That's called fiction.
We'll be back with this interview in just a moment. Remember, you can listen to this and every episode without ads and without these pitches by becoming a patron of First Draft at patreon.com/firstdraftwriters.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
eBay Motors is here for the ride. With over 122 million parts, you can make sure your number one ride or die stays running smoothly. Brake kits, LED headlights, bumpers, whatever your baby needs, eBay Motors has it. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time. Plus, at these prices, you're burning rubber, not cash. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only, exclusions apply.
Well, something you say in there, and I think it's in a whole chapter, is when you're talking about human emotions and the things that we avoid in life, like part of the beauty of fiction is you can go to the rumble or you can go to the gang fight, but you don't do that in real life. But you say that we don't go to enough of the emotional places. You say slow down where it hurts, get emotional, and that people avoid that in books.
I wouldn't even say get emotional. I'd say you are emotional. Allow yourself to experience that emotion, not as an enemy of your art, but as an opportunity to do something productive. I think stories come from productive bewilderment. We're bewildered by why we choose the wrong partners, why people leave us, why people get sick and die, why we feel a declining sense of our own worth in the world, or we never quite feel worthy of love. And like all these things are bewildering. And if we're honest about it, they're really upsetting. We walk around in a lot of pain. And good art somehow is able to tell stories about that pain that make us feel less alone and less crazy and less isolated with it. And at the same time, because we live, not just as writers, creating our art, but like as partners and children and parents, and we're constantly having to try to keep it together. And it's very disruptive. I think this is why people are socialized out of their obsessions, because at a certain point, parents say to their kids, hey, enough. You care too much about Legos. You care too much about manga. You care too much about Harry Potter, whatever it is. And all that does is springload our obsessions with the force of suppression. We bury them underneath and we sort of go along to get along, right? And it's quite unnatural. And one of the things that I love in writing is that you get to experience people who have gone to that urgent, obsessive place. I'm so not interested in the subject of many articles in like New Yorker stories, for instance, or nonfiction books. I didn't pick up The Spirit Catches You and You Fall Down, the Anne Fadiman book. I didn't sit there and say, wow, I really want to read about the Hmong culture and how they interacted with the American healthcare system. I had no interest. I had no dog in that fight. I didn't even know who the Hmong were. But I was completely riveted by that book. Why was I riveted by that book? Because Fadiman is so paying such careful attention. I really believe that it's not the quality of the life or the subject or the event that matters. It's the sense of urgency, the quality of attention that's paid to that particular part of the human experience that makes writing really exciting. And to me, that comes with obsession. the default system of our consciousness is to be obsessed and care too much about them and feel too much about them. And that to me is what I'm trying to urge people to do. Like, as one time I this friend of mine said, I was asking about the short story collection. He said to me, he looked at me, he said, Oh, Steve, it's so sad and depressing and it's heartbreaking. And I loved it. That's how I feel. Tell me where the deep emotion is. Tell me what writer has been able to take that molten emotion and like craft it into a beautiful, recognizable story that I will recognize as partly my story. I have my own version of that story of romantic suffering, of family discord that I've been unable to move past, of feeling stuck in some way, of blowing up a relationship that was once sacred to me. Like, I know that story, and I don't want to be alone in it. And that's why when you go to a great book, you just feel like, oh God, thank finally somebody understands my crazy.
Yeah. I mean, and you mentioned nonfiction, The Spirit Catches You and You Fall Down. That's such an incredible book. I think that's one of the first books I read where I realized, oh my gosh, I love nonfiction. And when I think about the books that I've read that have stayed with me, a lot of them, maybe even more of them, are nonfiction stories that are told with so much emotion about subjects you would never be interested about. And you write a lot of nonfiction, and this book is not isolated to fiction. So your concepts go to both.
That was a big intention. I think when I wrote this thing, I just wanted to, and it was over many years, right? So I'm writing essays about narration and thinking about narration like 20 years ago, teaching at the Tin House Conference, trying to figure out how to explain what I mean by a strong, independent narrator. You know, it's been written in a kind of ad hoc way over many years and many classroom experiences and stuff. But I think overall, the feeling I wanted was to say, look, writing is not some mystical pursuit. You don't have to say om and you do a certain ritual in order to get into the spiritual plane in which you can write. And it's not purely technical. It's really you sitting alone usually and making decisions. And those decisions, you boil away all the romance, it's decision making. And, you know, and usually you feel a lot of doubt about those decisions that you're making. And then you have to contend with that. And, you know, kind of getting shut down over that doubt or expressing that insecurity by overwriting, whatever it is. But I had a feeling that this should apply to almost any creative endeavor, that anybody who's trying to create is really trying to make decisions. And they're trying to make decisions and step back from those decisions and say, okay, that was just a set of decisions I made at a particular time. They are not about whether I'm good enough to tell the story or I have a right to tell the story. They're just the decisions I made at the time. Could I make them any better? Could I make them more dramatically satisfying? Could I make them more truthful, more merciful? And if you sort of detach, like, that mercy applies primarily to the writer. It's not like truth is the arrow, mercy is the bow. So when you're writing about that abusive parent, like, forgive them or be merciful to them. I do think that you should try to understand why they, in what ways they were hurt that made them hurt you. But I really mean you as the writer, the person claiming the right to tell the story, you need to be merciful to yourself and say, I'm just doing my best, trying to offer my version of the story so I can understand the meaning of what happened, not to indict anybody, but just to understand what we were all up to in those painful rooms. And that's kind of, I think when you're making a painting or a film or a song, there's some version of that same process going on where you're trying to make a set of decisions and you're, you know, sort of trying to tell a certain story. And at the same time, there's a part of you or there are sort of voices inside you that are anxious about claiming that kind of power in the world, especially if you are a woman, a person of color, neurodivergent, disabled, you know, any category that's marginalized. You have had the culture. I'm a white dude born into astonishing privilege. Left-handed twin who's Jewish, that's not really a category. Like, I had the world telling me, yes, we're interested in hearing your story. That's been the dominant, that's what we call history. It's basically the history of white guys abusing their power. I think that's a pretty good summary of what history is. But there are a lot of people who are going to pick up Truth is the Arrow, Mercy is the Bow, who have had just the opposite set of messages enforced by their families, enforced by their communities, and enforced by their countries, saying, we don't want to hear your story. It's disruptive, threatens us. It makes us have to interrogate our own privilege. And those writers have to work that much harder to realize, no. Actually, if people are telling you shouldn't tell that story and it's disruptive or it's irrelevant or they're not interested, you have to be that much more determined to say, actually, I really need to tell this story and I'm the only person who can tell it. So I guess that's in by my way of thinking, what I was trying to do was write a book that would empower as many people as possible to recognize their creativity as something they not have a right to so much as they have a great opportunity to do something with the painful, confusing feelings they have, all the questions that are floating around inside them. Not the answers, not the preaching or the demagoguery, but like the things they're confused about, the things that have happened to them that they're still trying to figure out. When people say, oh, what should I be writing about? It's like, well, you write about what you can't get rid of by other means. That's why people create, because they've got unresolved stuff that they're trying. And it's not therapy. That's a very different process. Nobody would want a transcript of my various therapy sessions over the years. They're completely, to most people, would be pretty boring. But when you create, you really are distilling, especially fiction or nonfiction or poetry, you're really distilling your experience and making sense of it in a way that it can connect to another person. It's not therapy, but it's therapeutic for me to encounter somebody who's really traveling deeply into truth. We actually even call it beauty, but it's truth. Whenever there's really beautiful, precise descriptions, it's not the language that's exciting. It's that somebody was paying that careful attention and they found just the right words to describe it.
So you talk there and you have a big section of your book where you're talking about how writing is decision making. And I think that is what can be so paralyzing about it. And I don't mean writer's block. I just mean when you go to write, the world is so incredibly open in fiction. Like your character, if you want to send him to Mars, you can do that. If you want to send him, even if it's a nice period piece and you want to send him, it's taking place in 18th century England and you want to send him to a sub, you can do that. So for you, when you're writing, what guides this? Do you feel like it's intuition? Do you feel like it's psychological consequences? Like how do you get from A to B?
I think some of it is figuring out organically what your character would do, what's driving them internally. And now I'm thinking about literary fiction, but I think any kind of good horror writing, I'm thinking about like Stephen King, Pet Sematary, right? That's psychological horror, but what's the real story at the heart of it? A man loses his daughter and he's heartbroken and he wishes to recover her. It's really basic. It's who do I care about? My protagonist, he's a father. And what does he care about? He's had a child die and he wants her back. And all the horror arises from that decision. That's your lodestar. Who do I care about and what do they care about? Once those two questions are asked and answered, you have the stirrings at least of plot. And once you are, sort of saying, well, what if it was on Mars? That feels to me like an inorganic decision, or it's a second order decision. Where's the setting? What's the milieu? The central question I'm asking anyway is who do I care about and what do they care about? What do they fear and what do they desire? Are they like Elizabeth Bennet? Are they looking for, how to find love and the right marriage partner? Are they like Natasha Trethewey in Memorial Drive, where they're trying to reckon with their own upbringing as a biracial child in the South, and especially in that amazing scalding memoir, reckon with the death of their mother, the murder of their mother, and therefore with the criminal justice system that failed to keep her safe because she did everything right and she was still murdered by an abusive ex. That it's, to me, it's very clear in a great book what the subject is, and that is some central protagonist who has a very urgent mission, something they desire, something they fear. In the best instance, those two things are combined. So they're, and the plot is really pushing up against, it's the mechanism by which you push that character up against their fear and desire. And anything that fits into that is good plot, is rising action, is what Aristotle calls the artful arrangement of incidents. It's you know, the decisions that a character has to make by which they're made happy or the opposite. And anything that's extra is sort of the writer getting insecure and saying, well, what else can I throw in here? Because I'm not quite sure what the story is. I rewrite paragraphs. And anytime I find myself rewriting, Mitzi, I don't know if you do this. Anytime I find myself rewriting a paragraph like 10 or 12 times, I know that I have a story problem. I know that I'm stalling because I don't know what the next beat is. I'm not able to get from A to B. And that means I need to do what Vivian Gornick recommends, to take a big step back from the situation and figure out in an elemental way, what is the story? What does my central character want? What are they in conflict about? And how can that conflict and tension be brought from the character's inner life out to the world?
You talk about plot in there, and you talk about it as, you know, causation, and it's not this happened and then this happened. Is that this happens and therefore that happens, and that plot is the pursuit of revelation. And you talk about it in the framework of two things, recognition and reversal.
Yeah, I mean, that's Aristotle. He essentially says, look, you know, it's not enough just because I had all these failed novels and I was trying to understand why did they fall flat. And what I realized was that I was writing in a very consecutive way, set pieces. This happened and this happened and this happened and this happened. And I think of it as almost like there's nothing that's rising in that. It's just consecutive. And after a while, it's exhausting. It's a chain of associations, but it hasn't been cleaved to a chain of consequence. And the things that create that consequence is, as you say, causation. This scene happens. My young protagonist in All the Secrets of the World, the novel I was mentioning with Nancy Reagan, walks into the home of a rich, wealthy classmate. And because of that, she comes to the attention of the mom and the dad, who are both sort of have ideas about her and are predatory towards her in ways that are incredibly dangerous, but also really exciting for her. Because it turns out that she's wanted to become visible, even though it's dangerous for her to be visible because her family's undocumented. And once she walks into that house and she establishes a relationship with each of the parents and she wants more from them and they want more from her, you have a chain of consequence. And, you know, to my way of thinking, that is what is sort of pushing you towards revelation, is that the stakes continue to go up. You're sort of trying to ask, what kind of danger can I get my character in? Or what kind of, it's different than that. It's not what can I get them in. It's what kind of danger is this character destined to get in? If I put them in the right places, if temptation is set before them, are they going to suffer that burden of hope? Right? Because we think of hope and, you know, we think, oh, hope, like on the Hallmark card. But really, it's a burden because it means somebody wishes for something ardently. And there's always the possibility that they might not get it. And that's, you're in the hope business. You know, that's whenever we click into a narrative, whenever we click into any kind of story, it's because we're hoping on a character's behalf. And that, you know, that vulnerability is something you have to be comfortable with yourself. You can't, I think if you're inhibited, you'll hold yourself back and you'll sort of write what I think of as like characters who are the alienated. You know, they're sort of mysteriously wounded. I think of them as characters in a hole. In the book, I refer to them as characters in a hole. And they're kind of down there swilling, you know, sipping their misery cocktails and like smoking clove cigarettes. But you never really know, like, what is this person's deal? Like, what do they desire? What, before they got all alienated, what were they carrying? What hopes were they carrying? I read a lot of student work, and when I was editing a literary magazine, I read tons and tons of stories. And there was a certain genre of story that was like the married couple that is lost love for one another, and now they're sort of stumbling towards separation, or they're divorced and they're spiraling. And to me, the part of the story that was almost always missing is, how did they fall in love? What did they think the story was going to be in the most incandescent moment? What did they think this person was going to be to them, their beloved. Like, that's where the danger is. So, you know, my feeling is like, your job is to allow your characters to express emotions inside of you that are disruptive when you're away from the keyboard, but they're actually your job when you're at the keyboard.
Do you have a story about smoking clove cigarettes?
I mean, I went to school in the 80s, so I do sadly have a story about smoking clove cigarettes, and it involves a Cure. Remember the Cure? It involves a Cure tribute band, and it involves a young woman named Nancy again, who had curly hair and big brown eyes, and who I was so desperately in love with. And it, I remember smoking a clove cigarette thinking, this will get me on Nancy's radar. And it did for about a half a second, which was enough for me to convince myself that we were destined, and to take a long, miserable walk through the tunnels underneath the university where I went, where I was sure it would end in a clove cigarette scented kiss. And you can just imagine, Mitzi, that that's not the way it ended at all. It ended in me realizing, this person feels pity for me, not desire. How interesting. I'll have to write about that someday.
I definitely think about smoking clove cigarettes at the bleachers, like behind the school on the weekend.
They were so intense. And so they were, I mean, I don't know how they were ever really legal. It seems to me, I just remember how powerful they were. But they, I don't know, like a clove cigarette to me is like adolescence in a single object. It's like, it's just so strong smelling and perfumed, and it's so poisonous, and you're just pulling it into yourself and it feels so good, but you know that it's utterly corrosive. I mean, it's something kind of overwrought about that. It's like an overwrought cigarette.
I think a great takeaway from your book is the chapter about decision making, and that that's what writing is. And sometimes you're just maybe tired of making decisions, or you have this notion that there is a right decision when, at least in the generative phase, there might not be. Like, you have to just be open to doing something that might not work, but it will work itself out later, and you have to trust that.
Oh, I mean, the first draft, I call them shitty first drafts. You know, the SFD is absolutely essential, because that first draft has to be for you. It has to be the place where you have that freedom of association. You, if you, you know, if you just plan out the kind of book that you describe being a little bit frustrated by, sounds like the work of somebody who's like, they call them a planner rather than a pantser, or a gardener rather than a forager, that they so want to work out the schematic of the story that they suck the life out of it, which is that freedom of association, that improvisatory set of questions that overtake us when we're really excited by a character, which is what if, what if, what if, what if, rather than rebuffing the interest expressed to her from a predatory older male who's wildly inappropriate to, what if my central character is actually really drawn to that and excited? Oh my. You know, you have to be able in a first draft to have that freedom of association. It's for you, the writer, and to not worry so much about whether it's the right move or the right beat, and to trust that you get to revisit those decisions. The second and third and fourth draft, as you move through those drafts, they're more and more in consideration, not just of your brilliant muse and letting it pour out like Kerouac, man, but like, hey, what is the story I'm trying to tell, and how is the reader going to be included in that? How can I make sure that I'm taking them along on the ride? And, you know, but at least initially, your job is, and this is how I teach, you know, generative classes, is to try to disinhibit as much as possible, to get people to loosen up and allow themselves to be emotional, and allow themselves to go to forbidden places. That's what literature is. It's that kind of disequilibrium and anarchy brought into the discipline of storytelling, right? It's not just blah, scream therapy. It is, once upon a time, there was a very lonely prince who smoked clove cigarettes and, you know, found his beloved in the tunnels underneath his university. And long did he march around with her, gazing at her lambent eyes, and tried to set upon her lips a kiss. And dear reader, it did not work out well. And now he listens to The Cure all day.
You say in there, quote, storytelling is not some mystical pursuit. And I think, you know, your whole book lays out why. But I also have this sense that reading stories can be very mystical, and that there's some alchemy happening in the creation of the art and the reception of the art. And I just wanted to ask you about that.
And that's, to me, what is, if there's something mystical going on, it's that a species came into existence in the universe that is able to experience the universe, that is able to set a speck of, you know, a bunch of specks of ink onto dried wood pulp. And another one of this species can happen upon that, those specks of ink, and become so involved in decoding that symbolic language. It becomes so intuitive and powerful that they create an entire movie in their heads with no sound editing and no best boy or gaffer, just their own imagination gets so turned on and activated that they create an entire experience and come to know a character or a set of characters better than they know many of their own family. Like, how miraculous is it that our species can do that, that we have this thing called storytelling and stories that allow people living 6,000 miles away, 6,000 years apart, chronologically and geographically and culturally and in every other way removed from any familiar cognates. And if the story is written well enough, that total stranger will be completely bound up and be, you know, be having a deeply emotional, imaginative, psychological, and moral experience reading that story. That, to me, is absolute magic. And, you know, I mean, those stories from 6,000 years ago, that's the Bible, man, you know, or the Bhagavad Gita or whatever it is. Our holy texts are all stories. And that is the way that we transmit through time what it is like for us to live in the bewilderment of being human beings, this one species that is able to be conscious of ourselves, able to love so deeply and mourn so deeply when we lose and all the rest of it. So I think that process is completely beautiful and mystical, but I think explaining how it works doesn't have to, you know, to me, doesn't have to descend into like vagary. I think you could be quite precise about how certain decisions at the keyboard are more moving and more likely to, you know, involve the reader and get that mystical process instigated inside them.
We'll be back with this interview in just a moment. Remember, you can listen to this and every episode without ads and without these pitches by becoming a patron of First Draft at patreon.com/firstdraftwriters.
This episode is brought to you by ZipRecruiter. When you want the best, you have to act fast, especially when hiring for your business. You want to find the most talented people before the competition scoops them up. And the best way to do that? ZipRecruiter. ZipRecruiter finds top talent fast. In fact, 4 out of 5 employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate within the first day. And right now, you can try it for free at ZipRecruiter.com/Spotify. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire.
Since 1979, TireRack.com has been helping people find the right tires for how, what, and where they drive. They sell only the best, like the full line of BF Goodrich tires. Test results, ratings, and reviews are there to assist. Or try the Tire Decision Guide to get a personalized tire recommendation. Tires ship fast and free to you or to one of over 10,000 recommended installers. In many areas, they offer mobile tire installation. Shop BF Goodrich Tires at TireRack.com.
Can you read a passage from an author that influences you as a writer?
Oh, yeah. So I wrote a whole book. It's a short book, but I wrote a whole book about the book Stoner, which is this novel, 1965 novel about a very quiet academic named William Stoner, who has a very tough life. Let's just say it. And what I want to read, actually, because I love this passage and I never stop loving it, is just from the very end of the book. And it gives you a sense of the sort of two voices that can live inside of every creative person. In this case, he is creative. He was a teacher, and that requires like being a parent or like being, you know, even being a criminal. I think creativity is all around us. People are being creative all the time. But in this case, his creativity took the form of being a teacher. And so at the end of his life, he's sort of dying. He's dying. And he's looking back on his life. And the passage begins, "Mercilessly, he saw his life as it must appear to another. Dispassionately, reasonably, he contemplated the failure that his life must appear to be. He had wanted friendship and the closeness of friendship that might hold him in the race of mankind. He had had two friends, one of whom had died senselessly before he was known, the other of whom had now withdrawn so distantly into the ranks of the living. He had wanted the singleness and the still connective passion of marriage. He'd had that too, and had not known what to do with it, and it had died. And it goes on about all of his failures, and it's like merciless in apprehending them. And then Stoner falls asleep for a few minutes or a few hours, and when he wakes up, he feels very differently. And this is the passage that follows that. A kind of joy came upon him, as if borne in on a summer breeze. He dimly recalled that he had been thinking of failure, as if it mattered. It seemed to him now that such thoughts were mean, unworthy of what his life had been. There was a softness around him, and a languor crept upon his limbs. A sense of his own identity came upon him with a sudden force, and he felt the power of it. He was himself, and he knew what he had been. I love that passage so much, because to me, that voice of merciless apprehension is what you're dealing with as a writer all the time. And what you have to be able to do is say, it's not about whether you fail. You're gonna fail. The question is, can you learn from your failure? Can you esteem who you are and what you're trying to do, even if you're making decisions that aren't great?
Can you read a passage that was difficult to write, or something that changed a lot from the first draft, or something you liked?
The catch here is that I tried to write this introduction to Truth is the Arrow, Mercy is the Bow, as I told you so many times. And I finally settled on, when I sort of stopped trying to perform the introduction and thought, what gets across what I have to say about what writing can do, what stories can do? This scene came to me of being in this Chinese restaurant teaching. And so I'm sort of asking here, how is it going to go for me to teach these, you know, seventh graders in front of 300 adult teachers in this Chinese restaurant, which smells of fried garlic? How would all this go? My money was on disaster. The students looked solemn, dutiful, petrified. They were, it seemed to me, trapped in a kind of anxiety fugue, which years from now they would attempt to describe to some patient lover. Yes, that was the day I was plucked from my normal class and put on a bus. I believe it was a punishment of some kind. They drove me to a vast cafeteria filled with hundreds of teachers. Some creepy American man began raving. They said he was the teacher, but he was dressed like a vagrant. He ordered me to write a personal story, which I had to recite while the strange teacher stared at me. I probably don't need to tell you that not one student volunteered to read, nor that a sense of doom descended upon that room. But then the plot took an unexpected turn. A slender girl rose from her seat and, trembling only slightly, read a stunning piece of prose. It was about a bicycle that she had coveted as a child, a gleaming red machine with silver handlebars and tassels. She spied it in the main square of her town, resting against a fountain. Her father felt a bike would be a distraction from her studies, and her mother didn't argue with her father. In dreams, the bike shone under the white moon. She imagined riding it constantly. She could feel her legs pumping. When she closed her eyes, it was still there under the moon, slightly too large for her, incandescent. Once, when no one was around, she rode the red bicycle, or maybe she made that part up. It felt like flying. She rode it all the way to the next town, then to the moon. She never came back. Shiro, that's the translator, whispered his translation. It was urgent and dizzying. The girl's voice rang out like a hymn. When she had finished, there was a sustained silence, as if we were in church.
Do you want to say anything else about it?
Just that, you know, as I say in the book, I've gone looking for that feeling everywhere. And, you know, sometimes I found it in my writing, but more often I found it in the classroom. More often I found it via students who just find a story within themselves, are merciful enough to themselves to reach that deeply into the truth. And it's really powerful what happens, not just because they say, oh, I told the truth and I didn't get punished. It didn't go south. I wasn't judged. Or if I was judged, it was with admiration for my courage. But because it it models to the other students and to me, this is possible. This is why we're in this room. This is what we're up to. Human beings aren't telling stories to entertain one another. They're trying, although that's one of the reasons they do, at the center of it, at the heart of it, they're trying to understand what they've lived through and know that they're not alone in the most difficult parts of it.
Where do you write?
I write mostly in my little shoebox of an office where I'm sitting right now. That is, it is slightly larger than a shoebox, but not much larger than that. And yeah, it's a mess. It's like my head.
What do you do or where do you go to get away from writing?
I do like racket sports. I play poker with my buddies. As much as I can, I try to like take walks with any of my children who are willing to take walks with me. That's what I'm mostly trying to do when I'm getting away from writing is see if there is a human being within arm's length who will deal with me.
Who do you show your work to first to get feedback?
I almost always will show my wife, Erin Almond, who's a novelist, everything that I write. She's my first and last reader. And I think none of the books that I've written would be, they maybe would be publishable, but they certainly wouldn't be as smart and considered and thoughtful if she isn't reading them. And so she's the first person who reads them. She's also the last person usually who will read them.
How have you dealt with rejection?
I mean, a lot of clove cigarettes for sure. And their various proxies, you know, it depends on which rejection you're talking about. You know, when I was rejected at 35 after writing my big historical novel and my agent read it, you know, after months of sort of trying to hold me at bay and said like, ugh, this novel sucks. I would not say I reacted terribly well. I was furious and I also fell into a sustained depression. But that depression in its own way was an important part of the journey. It stripped away that writerly vanity that was kept telling me you're destined to write a great historical novel. That's not true. I was destined to write. I started to ask anyway a much more useful question, which is like, not what should I write, but what can I write? What do I wish to write? What do I feel urgently enough about that I'll get to the keyboard? So like rejection, it sucks, but it's also a necessary part of the process. You know, your job is not to just succeed. That's not your job. Your job is to be in the process of trying to succeed, which involves inherently a certain amount of failure and rejection. And if you don't want that and it's not good for you and your mental health, then doing something like writing and storytelling, especially, you know, trying to make books or stories that will be creative writing. I don't mean technical writing or writing that sort of fits into the great grid of capitalism. I mean writing that's interested in the inner life. Like it's hard to do. It's hard to make all those decisions in your little shoebox, even if you have clove cigarettes. It's really hard to make those decisions well, consistently, I've found. And anybody who's published, all you're seeing are their good decisions. And you have to remember, even if it's Kurt Vonnegut, my literary hero, when you go to his archive, you see all of the dreary short stories he wrote when he was trying to be Ernest Hemingway and Norman Mailer rather than just being Kurt Vonnegut. And there's like a decade's worth of them or more. And it's incredibly comforting. Like, oh, okay, he was failing too. All those heroes, you're only seeing the tip of the iceberg. They only got to that tip of the iceberg because there were a lot of lesser decisions and they learned from all those lesser decisions. And that's how they were able to get their work into the world. That's a happy version of it. Rejection is your friend. It's your teacher. It's your dark teacher. It doesn't feel good. But if you can learn from it, you're going to get better.
What is your favorite word?
You know, this is such a sneaky question because you're asking me to make a decision. And like, I mean, incandescent, oh my God, I've used that word over and over. Onomatopoeia, oh my God, what a little falafel of a word. Yikes. Deracinate, coagulate. I don't know, man. Merciful, I love merciful. I think I love merciful because it's like literally full of mercy. I like the word special because I used to play pinball as a kid and special had this like red light associated with it. There's like a sense memory associated with it. But all right, I'll cheat and say my favorite two words are clove cigarettes just for you.
Well, thank you so much. I so appreciate this conversation.
Mitzi, it was great.
If you like today's show with Steve Almond, author of the nonfiction book, Truth is the Arrow, Mercy is the Bow, check out my interview with Peter Turchi, author of the craft book, Don't Stop Me, if you've heard this before. We talked about whether there is a right or a wrong way to write, the Iranian film A Separation, and feeling the writer's authority on the first page if they've done their job correctly. You can find that interview in the entire First Draft archive of more than 450 interviews at firstdraftwriters.com. You can stay tuned to First Draft on social media, on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, and Threads. Just look for First Draft ADOW. You can email me at firstdraftwriters@gmail.com anytime. Remember, there are plenty of extras for becoming a member and donating to First Draft, including access to pitch-free, ad-free content, as well as cuts from the interviews that didn't make it into the final show, writing tips from my guests, and more. Join me as I reach for honesty, vulnerability, connection, curiosity, and insights on craft with each episode. I can't tell you enough how much each and every single dollar counts to keeping this show alive. The first tier of support is just $6 a month, so please go to patreon.com/firstdraftwriters. Coming up in the next few months on First Draft, interviews with Ada Limone, Carvel Wallace, and Tommy Orange. I want to send out a huge thank you to my patrons for making this interview happen. Your support makes First Draft a dialogue on writing, a reality, every week. Please stay healthy and safe. The theme music for First Draft was produced and performed by Murph Mahaffey. I'm your host and producer, Mitzi Rapkin. Thank you for listening.